Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Now, we were just speaking with Radha Agrawal, who has written Belong, Find Your People, Create Community, and Live a More Connected Life. Now, our second guest this morning is Tor Hansen, who has written the book Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Speaking of communities, in Buzz, he looks beyond the frenzied debates about dwindling bee populations to explore where bees come from and what makes them so remarkable. The story begins 125 million years ago when a wasp first dared to feed pollen to its young. It became a vegetarian, in effect. Bees helped spark an agricultural revolution and have been crucial to advances in everything from medicine to industry, neuroscience to architecture. To this day, they are responsible for as much as a third of the foodstuffs we eat. Tor Hansen, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's my pleasure.
Well, let's start here because I'm always curious how we figure out that in this case, 125 million years ago, we have evidence that shows that wasps fed pollen to their young. Where is the insight on that one?
Well, it's really a marvelous story, and there's still, you know, some information remaining to be learned about this, because the fossil record for bees, for many insects at that time, is really poor. But what we do know is this: bees evolved from the wasps, and they still look quite a lot like them, which mm-hmm. is why the two groups are so often confused. But wasps are inherently carnivorous. They are creatures that are constantly searching the landscape for other insects to hunt, or for scraps of meat to take back to feed to their young, or for spiders and that sort of thing. They're hunters by nature. Whereas the bees, that particular habit that separated them and sent them on their own evolutionary pathway was, as you pointed out, they became vegetarian. It was a dietary shift. And they did this right in the middle of the Cretaceous period, you know, which we typically think about as a time of dinosaurs, but there was a lot of other interesting stuff going on then, too. And they made this shift right at the same moment in evolutionary history where the flowering plants were just beginning to spread and diversify. And so that transition occurred at a time when flowers were still scarce, but bees focused in on them, began provisioning themselves and their offspring solely from the products of flowers, the nectar and the pollen, and it started this long co-evolutionary dance that has led to wonderful diversity on both sides of the equation, both the flowering plants and then their chief pollinators, the bees.
Right, and we can always kind of then look at the kind of the chicken or egg aspect of that. Which came first? Was it the flowers looking for the bees, or the bees looking for the flowers? I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship at the end of the day.
It is. There are, it's one of these things we call a mutualism, where both sides benefit. Although, you know, it's not as if it's this cozy, I'll scratch your back, you'll scratch mine sort of situation. Each side is really out for its own ends, you know, and you'll find all sorts of examples of manipulation on the parts of flowers where they actually are tricking the bees into pollinating without providing a reward. Things like orchids are famous for that. They look and smell like they'd have all sorts of nectar, and they lure the bees in and then deposit the pollen in a place the bees can't even reach on their bodies, and so the bees get nothing from that situation. And similarly, bees that try to cheat the system and chew holes in the sides of flower tubes to suck out the nectar and that sort of thing.
Right. Tor, Chris and I both live in Park City, in the Park City area, and we live at like 7,000 feet, and we have these beautiful mountains around us. We're always looking up in the sky. We have these hawks and eagles, and we're watching these incredible flying machines. And so one of the first things that struck me was I look at bees all the time, and I'm trying to figure out how they fly. I mean, the ratio of wings to body mass should preclude them from getting airborne. They're little chubby, hairy things. You know, I mean, how does this all work?
It looks ridiculous, doesn't it? Yes, so you've hit on something that, in fact, is a famous story from the 19th century that some engineers proved that, in fact, bumblebees couldn't possibly fly because of what you point out, the ratio of their body mass to their relatively small wings. But, of course, it was calculations based upon fixed-wing aircraft that were just being developed at that time, and the fixed-winged aircraft that we look at, you know, at and use today, you know, our airplanes and such. But, of course, the wings on a bee are anything but fixed. They are incredibly flexible and can move back and forth as well as up and down and move at an incredible rate of flapping that give the bees really terrific aerodynamics. In fact, there are these wonderful experiments, speaking of mountain bees like you have there, in Park City, wonderful experiments where they wondered how high can bees actually fly, and they did these experiments on bumblebees native to the Himalaya, and put them into chambers that mimicked the air pressure above the height of Mount Everest, and found that in fact the bumblebees were able to adjust their wing motion and the trajectory of how they were flapping to stay airborne at, you know, elevations over 30,000 feet.
Wow. So that's an incredible amount of energy that has to be expended by them to not just fly, but fly great distances during any course of the day, which means then they must be really, really hungry all the time.
Well, their days are definitely centered around foraging for food. They are constantly looking for flowers, not only to feed themselves, which is primarily fueled by nectar, the sugary secretions of the flowers, although adult bees do eat some pollen as well for protein. Mm. So they're constantly looking for nectar sip to feed themselves, and if they're a honey-making species, to use it to make honey back in the nest or the hive. But also then, you know, gathering that pollen, which primarily goes back to the nest or hive to feed the babies, to feed the larvae that are developing there.
Tor, I learned so much from reading your book, and one of the things that just really surprised me was when you talked about bees can detect the tiny electromagnetic fields given off by flowers, so they can sense a change in a field if the flower's been recently visited by another bee. Can you talk about that and this sophisticated antennae that has 7 sensory organs on it?
Yes, so when we were kids, and it may be the same for you, we always called the antennae on bees or other insects feelers. And then somewhere along the way in my education as a biologist, that was drummed out of me, and these are antennae, and you can't call them feelers. But now that I know more about them, I actually think that feelers is a pretty good word. These are the sensory organs for insects, including bees, and they have an array of separate organs fixed upon them. You can imagine, if you will, you know, having your nose at the end of a long stalk that also includes your taste buds and sensitive fingertip-like skin, as well as things that measure air pressure and wind speed and direction. They're incredibly well attuned to the environment around them. All sorts of senses for navigation, and also for, you know, sophisticated detection of chemicals, in that bees communicate often among themselves through the use of pheromones, and they also have this need for detecting flower scents from great distances, and they can do so from surprising distances. It's been shown bees can navigate to a flower from half a mile away based solely upon that faint, you know, plume of aroma drifting from the flower in the breeze. So they're really wonderful organs. And then you also bring up this great discovery that bees can also sense electric fields around flowers. And this comes from research done primarily on bumblebees, which are, you know, very hairy and fuzzy. And what they've learned is that, in fact, bees flying through the air develop a slight positive charge, whereas a flower being fixed to the ground has a very slight negative charge. And so this benefits the relationship in a couple of ways. A bee then landing upon a flower and collecting pollen, well, opposites attract. So that pollen actually can be attracted to the hairs on the bees because of that difference in charge. But then what's even more interesting is what you bring up, is that after a bee has visited a flower, the flower's charge is subtly altered because of that interaction of positive and negative, for some period of time before it returns to its equilibrium of that slightly negative charge that it gets from being attached to the earth. So that other bees, then, flying through that same patch of habitat, can sense as they get close into a flower whether or not it has been recently visited. And that's vital information when they're foraging, because if a flower has been recently visited, then they know it's already been stripped of its nectar and potentially its pollen. So they'll move on if,
right,
in fact, they sense that difference in charge.
And that improves their efficiency. Right, I guess.
It improves foraging efficiency, which,
right,
as you point out, is so vital because they're hungry, hungry creatures.
Well, I was talking to my one friend about this upcoming interview, and she wanted to know how do bees, in a sense, find their way back home at the end of the day, either to their hive or, for in case of bumblebees or solitary bees that live in a single dwelling, because they can be miles away at some point from,
yeah,
their home.
So if you've ever, encountered a bee out in nature and maybe you've been wearing a nice bright blue shirt or something that they thought was a big flower, what you'll often notice, and pay attention to this, is a bee that inspects you will then circle and often rise up into the air. So bees use a combination of great memory and great directional skills to navigate through their landscape. But when they circle you and rise up, they're memorizing that location, and you can see this happening in individual bees, or if you are near a nest of bees, you often see this circling behavior. Mm. And that helps them memorize, fine-tune their sense of where they are, whether it's a patch of flowers they want to return to, or whether or not it's their nest or hive, when they memorize landmarks around it and the position of those landmarks towards the entrance to the nest, so that, in fact, shifting things around the nest of a bee can really confuse it when it comes home from a foraging bout if things are different. So there's great memory involved, and then also a really wonderful ability to navigate, as we mentioned earlier, based on things like scent in terms of searching out flowers, but also they sense differences in polarized light and all kinds of other cues from the landscape, whether it's directional north and south, or having to do with the position of the sun, or all of these various things that they can use to navigate. And they turn out to be phenomenally good at returning from even very long distances precisely to the nest, or returning back to a patch of flowers that they have been foraging upon. And this is most famously demonstrated by what they call the waggle dance of the honeybee, which is a way for this highly social species to communicate to other members of the hive about good patches of flowers that they're foraging on. And they do this series of motions described as a dance, body motions that other bees observe, and that tells them the direction and distance and quality of the item in question.
Right.
And, scientists who studied this have been able to decode the waggle dances going on at a hive and then go out into the landscape and use it just as if they were bees to find, in fact, where those bees are going. And sure enough, there are the bees themselves decoding the dance in the same way. So it's a remarkable way for them to communicate what they have learned in their foraging paths.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Tor Hansen. He's a conservation biologist, a Guggenheim Fellow, and winner of the John Burroughs Medal. His books include Feathers, The Impenetrable Forest, The Triumph of Seeds, and the children's favorite, Bartholomew Quill. We are speaking with him this morning about a new book, Buzz, The Nature and the Necessity of Bees. And back to the waggle dance, all the bees in the hive can't keep their eye on this one bee that's trying to communicate. Do they try to help that bee by mimicking the waggle dance so everybody can? Do they share this? How do they share this dance amongst others?
It's a great question. Mm-hmm. So it is communicated by the the bee that makes the discovery, if you will, or bee or bees. And then once that begins, you know, you have more bees visiting and communicating the same information. So you can often have, you know, several of these waggle dances, if you will, going on, you know, at the same time or close to one another. And almost in a sense of competition among these foragers to communicate which is the best resource. And this goes also towards finding new hive locations. When a swarm is going on, you'll have bees going out looking for new places for the hive to disperse, or the half of the hive that is on the move. And they'll also be sort of competing amongst one another to communicate about their location, the location that they've chosen, the hole in a tree or you know, the wall of a house where they think they might want to move the hive. So these things are communicated initially by an individual, and then as more bees begin making those trips, other individuals will pass along that information. So you quickly get the message spread to a huge number of bees in those highly social honeybee colonies, which, as you mentioned, and we should point out, is the sort of bee that we're most familiar with. We think of these masses of tens of thousands of bees and a single queen, but that really is the exception for bees, in that the vast majority of the world's 20,000 species of bees are solitary creatures, a single female with a small nest that she is tending all on her own.
Tor, the first bee, as you mentioned in your book, was 125 million years ago. And you also talk about this fascinating relationship between bees and humans and how we domesticated them over 5,000 years ago and the relationship that we have with them. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, what you've hit on right there is that our relationship with the domestic honeybee is really old. I mean, we domesticated these creatures far before we domesticated, you know, horses or camels or ducks, or before we developed familiar crops like, you know, onions or oats or even coffee. Precious coffee came to us long after the bees. And this is well known, in that we have good historical records even from the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, where very sophisticated clay hives were used to house domestic honeybees, and they were ferried up and down the River Nile in time with blooms of wildflowers and crops and other things. So it was very well understood at that time. And that makes sense, because in the ancient world, not only were bees our greatest source of sweetness through honey, but also our greatest source of light through the wax that the hives provided, that were used for beautiful, you know, clean burning candles. And then all of these other uses for the honey and the wax, whether it's medicinal or whether it's industrial, for metal making and for, you know, erasable writing tablets and all sorts of things that were used, including one of our earliest and most reliable sources of intoxication through mead or fermented honey. So all sorts of things made the domestic honeybee crucial to in the ancient world, and crucial now in the modern world as well. There's another very fascinating line of thought out there through some recent research into the diet and the dietary habits of hunter-gatherers in East Africa, particularly the Hadza people, who live a subsistence lifestyle in the very same landscape where people are thought to have evolved. And there are anthropologists now making a very sound argument that our relationship with bees should not be measured in the thousands of years, but rather in the millions, in that these modern hunter-gatherers seek out honey on a daily basis. It's not just an occasional treat. The honey makes up, for the Hadza, fully 15% of the diet, and even more so if you start to include the pollen and the larvae that are also consumed when a nest is located. Not just of honeybees, but of honeybees and at least six other honeymaking varieties in that landscape. So if you roll this back and put it in an evolutionary context, it becomes a really powerful idea, in that why would our ancestors, whether we're talking about Homo erectus or Homo habilis or even Australopithecus, these ancient bipedal primates in that neck of the woods, why would they have done anything different? I mean, we know that chimpanzees eat honey, so why not these other primates at that time? And that is a fascinating notion because the story of human evolution has always been a story about brain size, about the leaps in the size of our brains that have allowed, you know, these great advances for our species. But the brain is what physiologists call metabolically expensive tissue. It is a sort of tissue that takes a lot of energy, in that even now we expend, you know, as much as 20% of our daily calories fueling the brain, which is only 2% of our body. So if you want to have a big brain, you need to have more fuel. And anthropologists have typically looked at the history of human evolution, and any time there's been a noticeable increase in brain size, the theory is that that's been associated with some difference in habit or culture of our species that has allowed more calories, whether that was the advent of hunting or stone tools for more efficient hunting and gathering, or the advent of cooking through the mastery of fire. All of these sorts of things have been associated with increased brain size. And this new line of thinking now suggests that honey and bees deserve a seat at that table, mm-hmm. and that this habit of hunting and finding honey would have given a huge sugary blast of calories for our ancestors, and that, in fact, a lot of these same advances in tool use and fire would also have allowed, you know, the excavation of tree nests of honeybees from baobab trees and other things, as well as the pacification of bees through the use of wood smoke. And so suddenly there's this possibility that there is a nutritional boost in our history that we've been missing all this time that is has to do with our primordial sweet tooth and our ancient association with bees.
Tor, we only have a couple minutes left, but I do want to touch or have you touch on the four Ps, those issues that threaten both honeybees and bumblebee populations.
Certainly, yes. So in the modern era, it's impossible to talk about bees without confronting the challenges that they face. And I think we're concerned about it because of, you know, the great service they provide in pollination and crop production, but also really because of this ancient relationship we have with them. This is an insect, and perhaps one of the only or very few insects that people really have bonded with over great periods of time. So we have a deep relationship with them. And we've been very alarmed to see the numbers of honeybees dropping in recent years, as well as from the data we have, you know, the diversity and abundance of many native bees as well. And the colony collapse disorder that sort of brought this to the world's attention in 2006 spurred a lot of research that has led to the conclusion that, in fact, it's not just one malady, but rather a number of stressors that are affecting bees. And several of the most important ones have been summarized now as the four Ps, meaning pathogens and parasites and pesticides that we use commonly now in agricultural settings, as well as many backyards and things. And then also the fourth one being poor nutrition, the simple scarcity of flowers in many of our developing landscapes. As well as in agriculture, where right. we have gained great efficiency by growing single crops at mass scale,
right.
but have done so at the expense of floral diversity and bee habitat, in a sense.
We got to wrap up. I've always considered bees and honeybees and now bumblebees as like geniuses of the insect world, architecturally, socially, biologically, chemically. And you know what, Tor? 90-95% of them are females. That's a whole nother story we can get into another time. But the name of the book is Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. The author is Tor Hansen. Tor, again, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Hey, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for all the great questions.
Yes. Okay, thanks, Tor.
Bye-bye now.
We shall return right after these messages.